has quieted down, so let's go ahead and get started while we can. First order of business is to approve the meeting, the minutes from the last meeting. Everybody have a chance to read them. Anybody have any changes or?
Mr. Chairman, I was sort of here in spirit in last meeting, but I wasn't here physically, so I appreciate the they counted me present.
Well, spirit's important, but we'll make that adjustment. Yes.
There should be the word mandatory before permit.
All right.
I called in.
Oh, sorry. I did it with mandatory. For, I put it on the next day.
Okay.
That's my mistake.
Okay, thank you.
Any other changes? I guess we're still missing a few people, but the traffic was nasty, so. All right, a motion to approve with the changes that we've recommended. Somebody make a motion?
So moved.
Second. Motion approved. All right, and then we'll get down to business. Rob, who's going to, did he leave? Oh, here he is.
Had to do that. I know you have one presentation from the public.
Yes, sir.
So what I would recommend, I have a few comments. Maybe take the presentation from Mr. French. And then Ryan Jorley has a small presentation from information you didn't see last time. And then, of course, it's a big discussion. So for our part, since we last met, I had an interesting conversation with a lot of different people. I can't say they were real fruitful, but Wes Blow had talked to me on my way back from Baltimore one afternoon, and despite me telling Wes quite often that there was no way that the other states south of us were going to be that interested in closing their seasons early to accommodate Virginia, he finally convinced me about 25 minutes down the road that it was the fair thing to at least send them that information, which you'll see in a little bit from Ryan, where we would have 215,000 pounds. And the other states would have their share according to 2013-15 harvest data, which I thought was a pretty reasonable way to do it, considering that the information that we're going on for the June 20th closure in federal waters and everything else is based on those 3 years. So I did send that along to Michael Larkin of National Marine Fisheries Service. He worked up the closing dates, and then I followed up by calling Georgia, South Carolina, and North Carolina. And Georgia was very polite. The director down there, who I know, was a little alarmed that that closure would take place June the 9th, and we left it at that, but it was a polite conversation with an indication that maybe the ASMFC should get involved in these state water issues. So I moved on to South Carolina, talked to Robert Boyles, and Robert, very nice person, and he indicated that they had a situation where they're going to close anyway, June 20th. So as soon as the federal waters are closed, South Carolina closes regardless. And he had some concerns about ASMFC involvement along the lines of be careful what you ask for. Well, I followed up with him, and he then was very supportive of getting the ASMFC involved because he realized that, you know, at that time, I think 82% of the harvest is occurring in state waters. So he was fine with the ASMFC part. And all along, back even on March 10th, when Michelle Duvall was at the South Atlantic Fishery Management Council, you could hear her asking Roy Crabtree about that or indicating that ASMFC should be involved. And Roy Crabtree, who's the the National Marine Fisheries Service Regional Administrator, he agreed with that as well. Lots of talk with North Carolina. We have pretty good information that North Carolina is not going to close on the 20th of June. in their state waters, but the latest, at least from the advisory panel, and there's three segments of their advisory groups, the northern, southern, and then the finfish advisory group. The way I take it, they're recommending a two-fish boat limit to go in place after June 20th. The commissioner and I talked to Colonel Kelly, who's the acting director right now. Lou Daniel resigned about, I don't know, 4 weeks ago, something like that. Talked to him and to Michelle, and there's still to be one conversation, and that's to occur between the commissioner and the chair of the commission down there. So the commission hasn't weighed in yet. I believe the date is May 22nd, 2 days before we'll have our public hearing on May the 24th. And the ASMFC is set up for a policy board meeting. So that will be during the May 2nd to 4th time period. Policy board is where the decisions are made on pretty weighty issues. So for example, there are management boards at the ASMFC for all the species, but when there's something that's really important, the policy board meets. So they'll meet on this. There will be a call this week with states from Florida to Virginia with the ASMFC. The purpose of that call is to set up how the policy board will run, you know, what will be involved. Also talked to Jack McGovern after we talked to Roy Crabtree. You know, we talked to Roy Crabtree and Michael Larkin about a week and a half ago with the commissioner and with other staff members, and that resulted in a letter that Roy sent to the commissioner. He hasn't received it yet, but in essence, it encourages the states to abide by the federal closure on the idea that if that doesn't occur, then additional restrictions may take place. And I think one of the things Ryan will tell you is we don't know for certain whether North Carolina, and it's, you know, the commission still has to rule in North Carolina. These are advisory groups. You're an advisory group. You're important. I wouldn't say you're not important.
Thank you.
But the commission is more important. Let's put it that way.
Right.
So the commission is the one that makes the final decisions. So we don't know about North Carolina exactly, but those decisions, both North Carolina and ours, will be made in advance of the June 20th expected close season. So there is a possibility that NIMS would shorten the amount of time that federal waters is open. They could do that pretty quickly. We were told before they put out a bulletin as to when the original closure was, it could be a matter of days when they would put out another bulletin indicating there's an even shorter federal season. The reason we found that out, because we asked about the size limits that you brought forth last time, increased size limits and establishing boat limits, and we were told, well, if the season's going to extend beyond June 20th, then, you know, definitely we could put out another bulletin and change that. So our inference is that if they can do that, they can certainly truncate that federal water season as well to try and accommodate for what North Carolina or Virginia or both end up doing.
Okay.
We spent a lot of time looking at options, the size limit options and the boat limits. As you probably know, it's not so much a complaint about MRIP, which you hear that often, but if MRIP had canvassed or censused some of these rare events, because that's the way MRIP will tell you, they're rare events to try and get cobia intercepts, but if they had gotten some of the ones where there were more fish involved, we may have had more to work with. So, you know, when we looked at North Carolina and Virginia, and Ryan will show that in a little bit, even with the higher size limit and a one fish boat limit, there's a 6 day added on to June 20th. So the closure would be June 26th. And it's a shortcoming of having a rare species to intercept. So I think that's probably most of what I can cover right now. And, you know, I will send out an email if there's anything. I don't expect a lot out of the call with ASMSC other than to say, here's what we're going to do. Here's the basis for what we're going to do. You know, so we'll have to see. I think the other thing is that, you know, we don't know if we go with the ASMSC, it could be a pretty quick process. South Atlantic Fishery Management Council is not going to give up its authority over COBIA, we know that. So it's probably the role that ASMSC would play. You probably remember we were talking about spiny dogfish earlier. You know, that's a situation where you have two councils involved in federal waters, and then you have ASMSC involved in state waters. So there are examples where ASMSC has gotten involved. And in fact, I'm going to say 10 years, I'm probably wrong. It's probably a little longer that the feds turned over Red Drum to the ASMSC exclusively. But that used to be a federal plan. Surprisingly, always to me to think back to 1990, but weakfish was a federal plan. It was under the Mid-Atlantic Council, and then it was turned over to the ASMSC. So if there are any questions, I'll field those. But
yeah, the meeting for the ASMSC next month will be in Alexandria.
Yes.
Is that committee that we're talking about, is that open to the public?
Yes. Policy board, yes.
Policy board. Okay, and did Mr. Crabtree seem to have any flexibility in trying to make this a more fair allocation than what we have now?
No, it was really up to the states to do that. In other words, it was really up to calling on the states to be fair and go by that situation. And I know that Wes sent a letter. We had talked 4 days ago, I guess, about what Virginia has done for North Carolina. And off the top of my head, well, we let them land about 3 million pounds of summer flounder here because they couldn't get into Oregon Inlet. Year before last and the year before that, we provide bluefish quota, commercial quota, to them on a fairly regular basis. You know, it's a matter of, I think you get down to a sovereign nature of a state and versus, you know, what neighbors are really should be doing, perhaps. But, you know, it was a great idea by Wes. That's why I took him up on it and sent it down to get analysis. But the other states, they're really not going to follow through.
Okay. Any other questions for Rob before we get started? All right. We'll go ahead.
Thank
John.
You.
Jonathan, are you ready to?
Yes, sir.
Appreciate it.
So thank you for the opportunity to present today. I know that this isn't a standard practice, and I appreciate you indulging me. I represent a small but growing group of COBIA stakeholders. We're informal, no cost to join, sharing information. We don't even have a name, but it's a group that's grown to, in essence, probably 50 or 60 stakeholders at this point, many of which have signed on to a letter, not all because the letter doesn't represent a consensus position, but many of which have signed on to a letter that's been provided to you via email with recommendations. We've briefed the United States Senate Committee on Commerce, which is currently in discussions about reauthorizing the MSA to avoid something like this from happening in the future. It's interesting that the word fair was brought up. And Mr. O'Reilly said fair was North Carolina changing their policies to accommodate Virginia. I would disagree. Fair would have been NOAA following the standards in the Magnuson-Stevens Act in the first place when determining, first of all, the regulatory levers that were put in place, the accountability measure that was put in place, which was a closure only based on an overage, no stair-step type of measures, and most importantly, the zone split and ACL allocation. And I've heard some words in other public meetings from NOAA officials saying how it wasn't a zone split and East Florida wasn't carved out. Well, if there was 1.4 million pounds for the Atlantic stock that was allowable in 2014 and East Florida gets carved out of that zone with 880,000 pounds and there's only 600 and some thousand pounds left, That got carved out of the Atlantic stock. So there's no way you can spend that in any other way. I'm here to recommend that Virginia should reject the closure and go into noncompliance. I'm not here to discuss a boat limit. There is not consensus amongst my group. I do have some feelings individually and happy to answer those in the public comment about my opinion on a boat limit, but I do think that there's some danger there because of the impact on future ACLs. The reasons for rejecting this limit, first of all, the regulatory levers that were created without Virginia representation. Again, South Atlantic folks have said there's proxy representation from the Mid-Atlantic Fisheries Council. I would challenge each of the members of the committee and the VMRC staff to show me where in the public record those proxies spoke out for Virginia's interests. They certainly were not opposing these closures, which gets me to point number two. National Standard number 4 specifically says that policies and specifically the conservation and management measures shall not discriminate between residents of different states. If it becomes necessary to allocate or assign fishing privileges amongst the various United States fishermen, such allocation will be A, fair and equitable to all fishermen, B, reasonably calculated to promote conservation, and C, carried out in such a manner that no particular individual, corporation, or other entity acquires an excessive share of such privilege. And this is important. Virginia is the number 2 cobia producing state in what's now the Atlantic Management Zone. It was 2 or 3 year to year, exchanging places with North Carolina and Florida before Florida was carved out. But at the same time, there were only 2 liaisons. And again, I challenge you to look through the meeting minutes, and if time's allotted to me, I'm happy to quote some things from the meeting minutes where those Mid-Atlantic folks were speaking for the interests of Virginia. There was no comment on the record opposing an ACL reduction, the zone split, the development of the accountability measures, or anything. And with a June 20th closure in a migratory species, any type of a hard end-of-season closure is naturally discriminatory against the state waters that are at the tail end of the migratory zone. There's no argument. The South Atlantic folks can't argue it. The NOAA folks can't argue it. Every single state that's in the South Atlantic Marine Fishery Council will have a full season, even with a closure on June 20th. The cobia are gone from Georgia. They're gone from South Carolina. They're gone from North Carolina, pretty much south of Rodanthe by June 20th. They're gone. There's no negative impact whatsoever to accept this closure. They all had representation. If you look at the makeup of the South Atlantic Marine Fishery Council, northern North Carolina does not have representation. The members of the council are either from Morehead City or they're state employees. So those folks are underrepresented. They are going to get hurt by the closure. Virginia, underrepresented, not properly represented, doesn't have a seat at the table. We're going to get hurt by the closure. That's discriminatory. We don't have to have any other conversation. We can argue here for the next 2 hours about the poundage caught. We can argue about how that data was collected. We can argue about some of the things that NOAA's done that I would argue is spreading misinformation, and I'm happy to discuss that. We can also talk about how Virginia's tagging data is cited in the fisheries management plan but never referred to. Interestingly enough, I believe some of that tagging data shows some Virginia tagged cobia that have been caught in the Gulf of Mexico, which will kind of blow this whole theory about 2 separate populations right out of the water. And that was the justification for doing the zone split. Again, I want to focus on the impact of the representation. Virginia, no representation. Have a June 20th closure. That's approximately 2.5 to 3 weeks of a cobia season in our waters. In North Carolina, no representatives from north of Morehead City. That means the Hatteras guys, which generally their season's going to start around May 1st, and those fish are going to move on around the Cape around June 15th, sometimes earlier if there's a big cold front that pushes through. They're not going to really be impacted. But the Oregon Inlet guys, completely season gone. If you're fishing on the pier in northern North Carolina, your season's gone. We didn't catch our first fish on Avalon Pier, and I fish a lot in North Carolina too, until July 13th. So I don't know how many of y'all pier fish, but trying to drop net a cobia and release it safely without injury to the angler or the fish is pretty unlikely. I'd imagine they have the same problems over at Buckrow and some of the other peers around the bay. Now look at South Carolina, Georgia, and East Florida. South Carolina had three votes. They're going to have a full season. Interestingly enough, South Carolina, if you look back at the South Atlantic meeting minutes, it was South Carolina representatives, I believe Mr. O'Reilly mentioned Mr. Broyles. Mr. Broyles was one of the first people to mention an ACL reduction for the cobia species in 2009. Let's keep in mind that's 4 years before any data, the fisheries management plan, any of that was developed. The stock assessment, fisheries management. They're already talking about it on the record. Greg Waugh, the executive director of the South Atlantic Marine Fishery Council, says in 2010, September of 2010, and I'm happy to quote him if one of y'all ask me to, says on the record, there will be a zone split, there will be an ACL reduction based on what the fisheries management plan says. I'm sorry, the stock assessment says. Stock assessment ended up saying that there needed to be an ACL increase and that the species was not overfished. That clearly didn't happen. So I, with the deference to the chair, I can either stop right here, or I'm happy to go into the issues with data acuity. I'm happy to go into the deep concerns I have about the ACL itself and a boat limit potentially negatively impacting future ACL allocations. I think that they're going to go down when we come out of the ACT period. I've had some conversations with NOAA folks, and they've tried to explain to me the magic formulas that suggest how it could go up. But the only species that they've cited that the ACL ultimately goes up is a grouper species in the Gulf, where they had lowered the ACL to such a punitive number, I think it was something like well over 1 million pounds down to 15,000, and they threw back another, or gave them back 5,000 and waved the flag like, see, we give the ACL back sometimes. I just don't see that that's possible. And then the other issue I did want to bring to your attention is the fisheries management plan itself has a significant amount of information. Michelle Duval, when I spoke with her, referred to the plan forcing them to have this closure and saying that they had to reduce the ACL and pointed to some language deep down in the document that said that the applicable ACLs for the Atlantic migratory group of cobia are 670,000 pounds, 630 for 2014, 630 for 2015, and 620 in 2016. Keep in mind, the stock assessment said the ACL should be increased, not decreased. But if you go into the preamble of Amendment 20B, this is in the Federal Register and it's cited in the letter that I provided you all, cobia zones, ACLs, and ACTs, based on the most recent stock assessment for the Gulf and South Atlantic cobia, this rule divides the Gulf migratory group into a Gulf zone, a Florida East Coast zone, and then takes the South Atlantic Council's jurisdiction for the Florida East Coast zone. The Gulf ACL is allocated between the zones based on the landings from 1998 to 2012's fishing years. And I'm underlining this. The South Atlantic Council is responsible for the regulations for the Florida East Coast zone, yet they've told us that we can't have any givebacks from the Florida allocation. They caught 880,000 pounds, or they got 880,000 pounds. They caught about 330 last year. Just keep that in mind. But South Atlantic controls it. This rule also, key language, this rule also increases the ACLs for both migratory groups. Both migratory groups, that's the Atlantic. In the same rule, it says, well, the Atlantic has to come down. That hasn't been corrected, that hasn't been addressed. So that I raise that as an issue, but then you go to the FAQs, which I think most of the fishermen in here that take the time to review some of this regulatory language, they'll turn to the FAQ document. The FAQ document says, this option offers increases in the current annual catch limit for both councils and is viewed as a fair and equitable distribution of the resource. That's in the FAQ. It's on the federal website. That's misinformation. I think there's been a whole lot of water muddied. I think that these policies have been developed in a discriminatory fashion against Virginia. I think that coming in after the fact, ex post facto, with the Atlantic marine fisheries folks, that doesn't address that problem. And frankly, I'm of the opinion that not only should you all reject this closure, but Attorney General Mark Henry should be suing NOAA for the way these policies were developed. And at the bare minimum, we should be starting from scratch with a new FMP, different proper Virginia representation, and an ACL calculation that's fair, equitable, and most of all, doesn't assume the overfishing that the current MREP formula does, and I'm sure other folks will talk about the data acuity. Thank you for your time. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, John. Does anybody have any questions at the moment?
I have one.
Okay.
If we end up going out of compliance, you said you had an opinion about the boat limit. I know North Carolina has talked about, or their advisory has voted to go out of compliance and have a 2 fish per boat limit. What's your opinion on that?
Okay. Well, I'll start out with, I know that the big elephant in the room is, are the feds going to come in and take over our fisheries? I've heard that mentioned in numerous public meetings by folks on your side of the table and ours. Here's the political reality. We're in an election cycle. Looks to be a very, very unpleasant, disruptive election cycle. We also are in a period where the House of Representatives has passed massive changes to the Magnuson-Stevens Act that restrict a lot of NOAA's abilities to do things like this, also requires them to use fishermen-provided data for the analysis, less leverage for MREP. We've authored some recommendations for giving very strict controls on NOAA, for example, extending the period of time using averages and having some stair-step measures put in place. I don't believe for a second that NOAA, given the very public, very ugly fights that they're having in Florida with Red Snapper, they've been sued multiple times by the state of Massachusetts on top of a lot of different New England fisheries groups for some of their proposals, in the midst of where the way they do business is seriously under scrutiny at the congressional level, that they're going to come in and have a public takeover of a fishery. I may be wrong. That's a game of chicken. Game of chicken. In terms of the ACL itself and the boat limit, how much do you guys know about the formula that was used to determine what the maximum sustainable yield is? I've seen pictures of it. I have a really hard time explaining it. It looks like one of those equations I had in junior year math that made me go and freak out. But there's one known quantity, and that's the annual catch. So any measure that gets put into place that reduces your annual catch, that's going to be averaged into that formula for future stocks. So the only thing we know about definitively is the catch. Now let's just take a formula. 670,000 times A times B was going to be equal one thing. If A and B don't change and you replace the 670,000 with 450,000, that number is going to be lower. Now, I've had Michelle Duval tell me, oh, that's not necessarily the case. I've even heard rumblings that people have been promised that the ACL won't be reduced because the ACL, according to the language that I read you all earlier, is 620,000 pounds for now into the future. However, the ACL gets recalculated the year after a new fisheries management plan and new amendments are developed. If you look at the South Atlantic meeting minutes from the last meeting where they're looking to address this problem, one of the things that's on the agenda for 2018 is a rework, a new stock assessment, and a rework of the fisheries management plan, including additional amendments. That will necessitate a new calculation of the ACL. We've had a reduced catch if we accept these closures and the catch does go down. We've had a reduced catch for 3 years, three-year average, 2018's worth recalculated. Without understanding fully what those other metrics are, and again, I'd love to hear what they are in nice, easy-to-understand language that doesn't assume 400 additional boats per day are fishing for these things. I think ultimately that it could be negative and reduce our ACL. So imagine a situation where we come back into compliance, we get under that limit for 3 years, and we open our season back up with the new ACLs, 400,000, 450,000 pounds. We blow it out of the water next time. We're right back where we started, and now we don't have anything to give back.
All right, John, appreciate it. I know you have more that you'd like to add, but we'll let some other people speak. Let me know if you want to talk after that. The next one was? Okay, Ryan.
So I don't know if this will be the best way to do things, but what I can do is go through my presentation, which I think coincidentally will either confirm, address some of the things that Mr. French has said, and maybe, I guess after that, if there's still some open questions, we could have that back and forth. But like I said, I think some of the points should be addressed in the presentation just because these are a lot of stakeholders have come to us with some of these concerns, and so we've had to answer to them as best we can in this presentation. So for those of you who were here last time, this should be mostly new stuff. We're going to start with a little bit of a review because I think showing the harvest is important because that's where this has all come from. This is MRIP data, harvest over the last 10 years. That red dotted line is our ACL, the quota for 2015. That was not in effect before 2015. I just drew that as an illustrative measure to show, you know, if this situation, Georgia through New York, had been in place the last 10 years, you know, we would have been over some years, we would have been under some years. But, you know, I think a couple things to point out. I guess a caveat, one thing is that this doesn't include the dead discards. So for those of you who know from the stock assessment, it's estimated at 5%. And so for, you know, if we killed 25,000 cobia, there's your harvest estimate. But for all those that were released, you take 5% of that. That could be as many as 5,000 more dead fish, you know, at 35 pounds, according to MRIP. So I think, if anything, you know, there's one reason to say that this is sort of a friendly estimate for us because it doesn't include those fish. And then, of course, we sort of have that other side of the argument, which is, well, holy cow, how do we get to 92,000 trips? And that's, you know, a number that certainly is, it can be head-scratching when you think about just the state of Virginia and how many cobia anglers are out there. But, you know, I think probably the most important thing is to just focus it on what our harvest was. Because that catch rate that's determined from the intercepts, the MRIP intercepts, that's what, you know, that's what gave us that initial benchmark of how we're going to determine that catch. And so if you can believe that we killed, you know, 25,000 cobia over 120 days, you know, not only down here in the Southern Bay, but up in the Northern Neck where they were, you know, definitely fishing for them last year, then, you know, maybe that makes it a little bit more realistic as opposed to just looking at that number of trips. And I guess the last point is if you look at the when this year cuts off, we're looking at 2011 was the last year that the stock assessment included data for. That was how far up it goes. And since then, overall, we've seen a little bit of a dip, but then it starts to go up in catch. And for those of you who have followed the stock assessment or remember our last meeting, we brought out that spawning stock biomass. It was the piece of paper that we held up. We didn't have it in the presentation. So I figured I'd include it here. This comes out of the CDAR for cobia, and this is basically our estimate of the metric tonnage of mature spawning female cobia in the Atlantic zone. And as you can see, in the last 20 years or so, we've been in a steadily decreasing spawning stock biomass trend. And that was sort of the warning sign that was thrown up by the folks at NOAA saying, we currently have a surplus of cobia, so we're not in an overfished state, and we're not currently overfishing because we're still, you know, above our maximum sustainable or, you know, below our maximum sustainable yield. But the fact is we're in a decreasing trend, and if this continues, then we're going to be in a position where we might be in trouble and need to enact some regulations. So that was some of the verbiage that came out of the stock assessment. And when you look at the high catch over the last few years and the decreasing trend, that's where some of the concern comes from NOAA's part. And I think, you know, pushing all the numbers aside, if we just use our common sense and say since 2011, is there less cobia fishing in the bay? Do we have the same amount of cobia fishing in the bay? Or are there more people? That's how, you know, you could come to the conclusion that maybe some regulations need to be put in place. Simply because some of this increased pressure and guys coming to us saying, yeah, we need to do something. There's a lot more boats in the water. And so that, of course, is a more qualitative point, not necessarily numerically rigorous, but it's a thought to keep in the back of our minds. moving next into this stock split, because this certainly came at a time when, you know, the fishery was on the rise in Virginia. We had this, you know, assessment that came out, and it's doing all these different things. But I think the most important point that we can get across regarding that is that all of these things are independent measures that all came out of one assessment. And so the belief that, you know, Florida had some evil scheme to steal our quota is not necessarily how it played out. In reality, when we had that 1.5 million pounds leading up to the assessment, that was them saying, okay, from Florida to New York is our Atlantic stock. But between the genetic studies that came out and the rest of the assessment, they said, well, the majority of the cobia that are in the east coast of Florida, we're actually recapturing them in the Gulf of Mexico. We're getting a lot more cobia recaptured in the Gulf than East Florida cobia moving north. And so the reality is that genetics and, you know, the split according to the study was Cape Canaveral. And so the reason they moved it north to Florida-Georgia line is just ease of management purposes, so that they wouldn't have to split the data on a county-wide level, which is something that MRIP certainly cautions against. And so I guess the best way that I could explain it is that they didn't take, you know, Atlantic stock cobia. It was always Gulf stock cobia, but we had just been misclassifying it, not having that genetics data. And so I think, you know, if you believe the genetic study and if you believe the stock assessment, that's what happened. It was not, you know, some voting matter where Florida said, you know, how about we get this amount of cobia, and the Atlantic state said, okay, that sounds fine. The stock alignment and the calculation of the ACLs were independent of each other. When you do a stock assessment, as Mr. French had said, the ACLs basically get wiped clean and they calculate new numbers. It's just a coincidence that through this same stock assessment, a genetics paper came in and said, well, actually, we need to split them up. So it was sort of a perfect storm of factors that led to this, which is certainly a bit confusing. But what I'll do is point to this direct quotation from the Fisheries Management Plan Amendment 20B for cobia and mackerel. I added in the underline just to show kind of the most important part of this, which is that East Florida's quota, or ACL, was actually taken as a direct percentage of the Gulf ACL. And so once they finished up the stock assessment and said, well, hold on, these are actually, you know, we need to do the split, they're also looking at the ACLs at the same time and said, okay, well, if East Florida is Gulf cobia, we need to figure out how much of the Gulf cobia is going to go to East Florida. And so the reduction in the Atlantic group was just part of the stock assessment, where they came out and said, well, we need to start ratcheting down the catch because we have this, you know, declining spawning stock biomass. This is just to add in a little bit more regarding that ACL, new ACLs and the split. If you look at the 2006 to 2014 average for each state, you see numbers where Virginia is the leading player, then followed by North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia. And if you add all of those up, that's at about 670,000 pounds, which is right around where that initial recreational ACL was set. So, you know, part of this whole reworking of the ACL, you know, was based on the stock assessment, but it also kind of lines up with what we've been seeing on average. Unfortunately, the reality with an average is that sometimes you're above it and sometimes you're below it. And, you know, that's not to say anything about how we deal with that, but it's just, you know, that's something that we have to figure out, you know, how to deal with. And in our attempt to, I'll try to address this ACL issue, because it certainly is confusing, and, you know, I'm not going to try to take anything away from Mr. French. If you look at the Federal Register version, it says, you know, the two councils will see an increase in ACL. But then suddenly Georgia through New York is seeing a decreasing trend from 2014 to 2016. First, I'll speak to the fact that our portion of it decreased. That comes from the stock assessment, and we spoke briefly with some of the people who were part of that assessment at NOAA, and they basically said, you know, in 2005 there was a very high, abnormally high recruitment year, and as we know, cobia live anywhere from 10 to 14 years, somewhere around there. it's about this time that we're expecting to see the effect of that boom start to wear off. And we were in that surplus as a result of that, and we were catching a lot. But now it's kind of it's time to get back to reality. You know, my word's not theirs, but the fact is, once you see that surplus from that big recruitment year start to disappear, you have to ratchet down that catch. That was their main part of the reasoning, because that surplus is starting to vanish. And in terms of the inconsistency in the Federal Register document, what they were referring to is that the Gulf Council and the South Atlantic Council will both see an increase in ACL. And that did, in fact, happen, but it's very confusing wording because you have to add Georgia to New York and East Florida. Because if you look at Amendment 20B, what they'll say is East Florida is Gulf fish, but it's still managed by the South Atlantic. And so it's, you know, like I said, it's confusing wording, but if you add together East Florida plus Georgia through New York, you get an increase of about 300,000 pounds, somewhere about there. So certainly it's a modest increase, but technically, yes, both increased, and it's just the Georgia through New York part of it happened to decrease. So, you know, I don't know that that's going to make anybody feel better, but, you know, I guess the thing to remember is that the Federal Register version of Amendment 20B is you know, a few pages summary, and the full document, which is much, much longer, goes into more detail about how they voted. You know, that quotation I pulled was, you know, alternative three, option D. So there was a lot of different stuff going on in it, and that's where they explain where Florida gets its 880,000 pounds from or whatever it is, and what happens with Georgia through New York. Speaking of ACTs, ACLs, just going to try to give a general summary of what happens this year, what happens next year. So as it stands now, you know, we try to use the three-year average when we can, but if you have an ACL change, then you're only going to use as far back as you can go to that resetting of the ACL. So in this case, we're able to use 2 years, and if the average of 2015 and 2016 is over that 670,000 pounds, then we fish to the ACT in 2017 as well. So we use the ACT as sort of a precautionary measure, but the penalties still aren't going to come if we exceed the ACT. It happens if we exceed the ACL. Now, unfortunately...
Define for the audience ACT and ACL.
Oh, sure. So please. The ACL is the annual catch limit, which is, like I said, that's where the penalties start to come in. The ACT is the annual catch target, which is, in our case, is lower than the ACL. And a reason being, with the accountability measures, the way they're set up, if you exceed that annual catch limit, which is basically the quota for the year, in a way to ensure that it doesn't happen again, the following year you go to that ACT, which in our case is 500,000 pounds for the recreational sector. So I guess technically what really happens is it has to exceed the stock ACL, which is commercial plus recreational, but, you know, with the commercial being such a small percentage of it, it doesn't take a very large recreational overage to kick above the entire stock ACL. And I guess something that's interesting to keep in mind is that depending on how big we go in 2016, you know, if North Carolina stays open, Virginia stays open, and we blow it out of the water again, that closure could come earlier than June 20th in 2017, which, you know, certainly from a rule-based standpoint is not very good. And I guess the other thing I was going to say is that because 2015 was so darn high, even if we caught zero cobia this year, our two-year average would still be over that 670,000 pounds. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean we're guaranteed to fish to that 500,000 pounds in 2017. At the March South Atlantic meeting, they brought up the idea. They said, look, there's nothing we can do in 2016 to prevent this from happening again. And so they recently put forth a framework amendment that would remove the three-year average and allow us to just look at 2016 harvest so that we're not continually penalized by this huge 2015 year. So that could be in place as early as December of 2016. So by the end of this year, We could be gone with the three-year average and just looking at 2016 catch, so that if we stay within that 670,000 pounds in 2016, we get the ACL back in 2017. So that, I think, is a really important point to think about moving forward, to try and avoid getting into this loop where we're just constantly fishing to the ACT. You know, there are certainly pluses and minuses to getting rid of that three-year average. You know, when we were staring down that 2015 data, we said, can we please look at 13 and 14, because, you know, or else this 2015 year, we're not even going to have a season. And so that's where it helped to have the three-year, but now that it's behind us, it's going to, you know, haunt us like the ghost of harvest past. So it's certainly a lot of trade-offs to consider, but everyone at the South Atlantic meeting seemed pretty interested in entertaining this idea. You know, part of that, what I was saying, is really going to come into play when we talk about should we go out of compliance or should we not. Basically, all NOAA cares about, I mean, this is a simplification, but the primary thing that NOAA cares about at this point is keeping within that 500,000-pound annual catch target. You know, heard reference to the Gulf of Mexico situation with red snapper. Basically, what happens is if the states say something that, you know, we're not going to follow the federal waters closure, we're going to have our own season, NOAA will basically just account for whatever, you know, whatever Louisiana catches that's more than what NOAA thinks they're going to catch, they'll take that off of the federal water season. And they'll do it in the same year. And I've talked to plenty of people down in Florida who are nonprofit groups, you know, people who are very avid fishermen for red snapper. They say, yeah, that's exactly what happens. Even if the states wait until the last minute, NOAA turns around and says, okay, well, instead of May 30th, it's going to be May 19th because so-and-so wants to plan on this much in state waters. And so that's what I imagine would happen in Virginia. And it doesn't matter that we're not deciding until the end of May. They just have to throw some different numbers in the calculations that they've already been doing. And they can say, well, shoot, you know, North Carolina and Virginia are going to try to catch this many fish. Well, that means we should have closed last week, so we'll just close tomorrow. And that's what I was referring to when I said you get into this loop of just fishing to that lower number, that ACT, because it's just so hard to constrain the catch at that point when everyone's saying, well, we'll take as much as we think we can take. And obviously that may not feel like a problem for Virginia anglers because most of our cobia are caught in state waters. But that's not necessarily the case for the rest of the coast. These numbers inside this table are the percentage of harvest that came from state waters. And so a zero means all federal waters. Georgia and South Carolina are almost exclusively federal waters cobia seasons. And so while it doesn't affect Virginia and it doesn't affect North Carolina all that much, it does affect South Carolina and Georgia pretty heavily. And we heard that expressed during the phone call with the gentleman from Georgia. You know, he said, holy cow, if, you know, if we have a windy spring, then we're not going to be getting out till June. So there's certainly concern from them. And, you know, I guess the point here is that North Carolina and Virginia tampering with their state seasons is most likely going to lead to a closure date that's earlier than June 20th for federal waters. And while that doesn't affect us all that much, it affects other states that we're going to have to come to the table with, you know, down the road, whether it be for cobia or for some other species. And so, you know, that's where some of the concern comes from. Just going to try to tie that into what Mr. Blow had put forth in terms of a suggested plan. He said, well, look at the last 3 years and see what each state has caught and divide it up that way, which obviously seemed like the most equitable way we could do it. And so the folks at NOAA did this calculation and said, well, okay, if we divide up that 500,000 pounds for the four big players of cobia and then have each state, you know, hypothetically close its waters when they reach that, Virginia gets to stay open until July 14th, but North Carolina is at June 6th, South Carolina's May 28th, and Georgia's June 9th. So a big concern is that all these other states who are predominantly federal waters cobia fisheries are going to be affected by this. And I know that, you know, the peak for South Carolina and Georgia may be in May or beginning of June, but the fact is if you look at the MRIP raw data for the last 3 years, Georgia and South Carolina both have harvest in July, and South Carolina even has harvest in August. Now, I'm not trying to say that that's the beef of their season, but to say that these closures do not affect those states at all is not quite reflected in the data. So, you know, the one problem is, it's not going to be palatable to the states that saw June 20th and said, well, shoot, now we can't even get to that. And the other problem is that it's the management plan through South Atlantic doesn't really accommodate for something like this to happen, and so it would fall on the states to get together and try to talk this out, which we tried to do with each of the three states and just you know, couldn't get them to agree to this type of plan. And so, unfortunately, it doesn't appear that something like this could happen. But I think, if anything, the fairness of that plan, or at least what we think to be the fairness of that plan, is really indicative of something that would have happened if we were already under ASMFC. And so, you know, the idea being, if we could get to that point where we have states coming to the table and agreeing on things that they would do in their state waters, then we might have been able to spread out the you know, the punishment a little bit more. So South Atlantic Council did send a letter to the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission, which was designed to help out with state waters management between multiple states. And they requested joint or complementary management of cobia, which, as Rob alluded to, it doesn't mean that South Atlantic's going away. It just means that the states have a little bit more of a structured and explicit plan for how they handle their state water season when something like this comes up. So that'll be discussed at the May meeting. And one of the possibilities is that it could mean state-by-state allocation. So that would be basically what that was, except officially saying, you know, Virginia gets this much, North Carolina gets this much, and, you know, enact your own regulations, make it work. And so, you know, going back to that idea of tampering with our season and, you know, kind of creating a sore spot for states like Georgia and South Carolina, we're going to have to come together and decide on that at some point. And so, you know, we have to decide whether or not we're going to roll the dice and say, you know, this may get us mad and it may affect us, you know, when it comes to ASMFC, but at least we get our season. Or you could say this just isn't worth it for one season. Let's wait till we get to ASMFC and do it right. So there's definitely, like I said, there's trade-offs to be said there. But, you know, some of the things to consider, potential problems if should we go out of compliance, is that, you know, ASMFC is going to make the rules and make the penalties based on what they see happening. And if they do come to this and say, yeah, we'll take cobia as joint or complementary management, you know, the penalties for noncompliance will be severe to prevent it from happening in the future, because, you know, obviously that's headaches for everybody. And I guess the worst case scenario in terms of ASMFC is that they could just say, no, we're not even going to accept this. We don't feel like we're confident in our abilities to get state compliance given what has happened in the past. And so, you know, trying to play this game of, you know, how do we handle 2016, how do we handle 2017 and beyond, becomes complex and very interesting when you try to think of how are other states going to react to our actions and how is that going to affect our ability to get our desired quota if we get to that point under ASMFC. So, you know, our goal in the meantime is to talk about some of the other stuff. We've certainly covered a lot in terms of whether or not the data is reliable or whether or not the management system is set up correctly or if it's unfair. But there are options to get us some days this year. And obviously we've talked about it before, but size and vessel limits can certainly give us some days. You know, unfortunately, we saw last commission meeting, and you'll see in a moment that, you know, these extreme measures are the only ones that are going to get us a lot of days. So here's a table that just shows a theoretical size limit in the leftmost column, your vessel limits, how much that reduces our catch, and what the closure leads to. And if you look at the bottom of the one vessel box, that's your maximum date. That's June 28th. So that's if we didn't do anything other than change those regulations. I guess a point to make that might increase optimism or at least decrease pessimism. At the bottom it says using only 2015 harvest data from Virginia. When NOAA did this analysis, they had only based it off of 2015 data, saying, well, that's when we had the most samples, so that's what we used. But in reality, when they decided upon the 2016 closure of June 20th, they had used 2013 through 2015. And so we replied saying, well, in the interest of consistency and fairness, could you include 13 and 14? And, you know, I went ahead and looked at the raw data, you know, all the intercepts in MRIP. And if you look at 2015, according to MRIP, we didn't have any cobia under 39 inches. So there were no 37-inch cobia, no 38-inch cobia. And so that's why you look at a reduction, or you're looking at pretty small increases in number of days. But if you go back to 13 and 14, it has those smaller cobia that we know our anglers are catching. It just wasn't reflected in 2015. So I'm pretty confident that once they include 13 and 14, you'll see some of these days increase, maybe even bleed into July a little bit. But, you know, it, like I said, it may not be as much as people were hoping for. But like I said, it will be more than this. The situation gets a little better if North Carolina were to comply. At this point, it doesn't seem likely, but if we had both adopted these regulations, which is what this table is assuming, then you start to see some dates in July. If you go really extreme, 45 inches with one fish vessel limit, you get to July 15th, which is extremely restrictive, but certainly get some more days into the summer when the charter season picks up. Once again, only using 2015 data. Yes?
Real quick, at the last FMEC meeting, I had requested the one-inch increments to see if we increase the size, and I asked for it to be up to 45 inches, and where's, like, 42 to 44? Where is that information? Because
there's
never got that.
There's a couple pieces of analysis that we're still waiting for. Like I said, we asked them to redo this, and something like that is still on its way. And so that, you know, honestly, that's one of the reasons we have moved the public hearing from April to May, is because we just don't have all of the information that we'd like to have. So that stuff should be coming down the pipe.
But they are working on that?
Yeah. So, once again, assuming they include the previous 2 years of data, that'll lead to more reductions, which leads to a later closure date. And so then some of these ideas might seem slightly more palatable. And this last option is an attempt at a compromise that one of our staff members had thought up. This 120,000 pounds, basically, when NOAA did its projection to lead to that June 20th closure, they were planning on Virginia catching about 120,000 pounds by June 20th. That's what they're projecting. And so one way we thought to do this is there any way that we can reallocate that harvest, stretch it out over a longer number of days by starting later, by changing our regulations for size and vessel limits, such that we have, you know, instead of those days in May and the beginning of June, how about we open up, say, July 1st, increase our size limit, decrease our vessel limit, and try to get those days in the middle of the summer that are most economically important for the charter captains, while at the same time not affecting that June 20th closure date that would perhaps raise the eyebrows of Georgia and South Carolina. So the goal here is to try and not do too much to impact the other states who, you know, to be fair, are already, you know, it may not seem like Georgia, South Carolina are suffering, but they are taking a small percentage cut. And the fact is, you know, for example, last year Georgia cut under its average. And so their federal water season is being affected despite the fact that, you know, they caught less than they normally do. So I think that's part of the reason we're trying to do something that accommodates for everyone. But at the same time, it's an attempt to get some days in July, God willing, get some days in August that would allow some of our captains to stay open. And depending on how we slice up that catch, we could see, you know, anywhere from 10 days to 21 days without even changing any of the size or vessel limits. So the big question mark is how will NOAA handle our projected May harvest? We know that hardly anybody's catching cobia in May, but the fact is, because our public hearing is at the end of May, we're not going to be able to decide until our cobia season has technically started. So the only thing that NOAA is going to do is say, well, technically, what you're really going to be doing is staying closed for the month of June and reopening in July, just because of when we're making our decision. So they have to figure out how much is Virginia projected to catch in May. Data in MRIP is clumped by two-month waves, which would put us at May and June. So they have to figure out, between our smaller May catch and our larger June catch, how much are they going to assume we're catching by the end of May.
You're talking about the wave segments. If you were to start the season in July, wouldn't that be eliminating the third wave altogether?
No, because we wouldn't be able to vote on this regulation until the end of May, which is when our commission meeting is. So, unfortunately, it just so happens with the timing of our commission meeting and when this public hearing is for cobia, we won't be able to decide until the month of May has passed. And so that's where the tricky part comes in, is saying, well, how is NOAA in their analysis going to assign catch to the month of May? We know that you can't just say, well, wave three is 2 months long, we'll put half the catch in May and half the catch in June, and we'll assume that half you're not going to be actually catching, and that leads to savings. But in reality, we know that most of the cobia in wave three are caught in June. So, you know, one thing we're going to try to do is get that point across so that we're not getting penalized for catch in May that won't actually happen. But that's getting down in the weeds. You know, the fact is we could get July 1st to July 21st without even changing size limits. And if we said, okay, well, how about just for this year, we'll go up to 42, 43, 44-inch total length, go down to two-fish vessel limit, see how much extra fish and how much extra days that buys us, we may get in August. And we sent the email to Mike Larkin, and, you know, that analysis, in addition to all the others we've requested, will be coming. We'll certainly be in place, you know, all figured out by the May Commission meeting. And so the commission will be able to weigh that against noncompliance, against accepting it, and all the other options that have been put forth. So just a little summary of, you know, what's covered and what we can do this year. You know, the fact is South Atlantic cannot enforce some sort of state water season where each state closes when it gets its share. You know, like I said, that would have been a great role for ASMFC had it been in place this year. Agreeing with North Carolina also would have been a good thing, but we may not get that opportunity, depending on how their commission votes. And then, you know, this is something we pitched last FMAC. We never really got around to discussing it, but, you know, what size limits, what vessel limits would be acceptable? How high would anglers be willing to go if this is the route that the commission votes? You know, the fact is they could either vote yay or nay on noncompliance. And so if they say we got to stay in, we got to do something, what we want is to have, you know, a plan that's at least hypothetically supported by the anglers. So trying to get a size limit, trying to get a vessel limit. If they knew it was only going to be in place for 1 year, would that allow us to get to a higher size limit? Just understanding that this is a reaction, it's temporary, it's just to get our guys some extra days. So that's sort of the summary of that. You know, what's at our plate? Obviously, we all know the other option of just keeping our season open. So I thank you all for listening, and if you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer them.
Can you leave the slides with the size limits on there, or the
this one, or the Virginia only?
Virginia only. All right.
Yeah. So if you follow the mouse, right here is the latest, and this is a pretty big cobia, 50 inches. That's basically you're only allowed to keep your citation cobia, and that gets us to June 28th. But like I said, I think it's going to be a little bit later than June 28th once we get these updated numbers. Unfortunately, by the time he got back to us, we looked at it and said, well, why isn't 13 and 14 in there? So we're going to have to wait a little bit longer on that.
How much longer? When do you expect to have that?
I don't know.
Yeah, hard to say.
Okay.
Mike Larkin is with three councils, so he's doing an analysis with three other councils. But give an indication how many fish we're talking about in 2013 14 in the intercept.
Mm-hmm.
How many fish did you see there that were smaller size or
smaller sizes? I mean, obviously, we're not talking half of the 2014 cobia were 37 or 38 inches. You know, so I, the thing that makes this difficult to predict is that, you know, as you get later, you have more cobia behind you and less in front of you. So it may not be, you know, 10% here gets you the same amount as 10% in the beginning of July. So unfortunately, I wouldn't want to throw a number out there and then be totally off. But, you know, if we had, you know, maybe 10% of the cobia were of that smaller size for 2014-13. That might be about it. But also at play is, were cobia on average smaller in those years, which according to AMREP and according to NOAA, they were. 2015 was on average the heaviest average cobia since 2009 or 10. So I unfortunately can't predict what this would look like. It would get us in, you know, if you look at this one, this would get us into to July, but, you know, I don't know if anyone's going to be willing to go up to 50-inch minimum size and a one-fish vessel limit. I know a lot of the charter captains, you know, lose a lot of their marketability if they can't keep those at least two for customers. So,
okay. Any questions from the committee?
Just that proposal with 120,000 pounds of fish. Actually, the most recent thing that Mike put out was that Virginia will only get out of that 500,000 pounds, 105,000 pounds of fish.
Yeah, we saw that email, and Rob or Joe can correct me if I'm wrong, but what had happened is he didn't adjust the overall analysis or the overall numbers. The 120,000 pounds had been all the fish that would be landed in Virginia. That most recent analysis had separated out federal catch and just lumped Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia's federal catch all as one category, and then did each individual state's state waters harvest. And so what that represents is 105,000 pounds is going to be harvested from state waters, but that 120,000 pounds is still accurate if you consider the federal waters harvest, which is, you know, if you take the three-year average, it's about that percentage of state versus federal harvest.
So with those numbers he put out, Virginia gets 21% of the ACT,
mm-hmm.
and North Carolina, not counting the federal catch, gets 57%. So North Carolina gets that much more than us.
Yeah. Well, and obviously, you know, the original proposal we had put forth, and, you know, unfortunately, you know, like Rob had said, all the states were very polite about it, but
polite because they were getting the lion's share of the catch.
Yeah. Well, but, you know, this 120,000 pounds we saw as our next best option as something we could get done in the next month or two. So we understand that it's certainly below Virginia's historical
catch. All along, that Virginia is getting the short end of the stick here.
Mm-hmm.
And we just shouldn't allow that to happen. You know, if you fact, Dad, his last calculations was 102,000 pounds in federal water. And you put up one slide there that showed approximately how many North Carolina got in the other states. So Virginia gets very few in federal waters, like you just said.
Mm-hmm.
We just can't accept, you know, another state that was almost equally responsible for what happened last year, getting 57-60% of the catch, and Virginia getting shut out. You know, you talked about if we do something, then it's going to make those other states mad at us when they go to do something. Well, what about us this year? You know, shouldn't we be mad that, you know, we're getting almost the majority of the responsibility of what happened last year?
All right. Okay, we'll go to the the audience then who wants to speak. John, let's wait and give somebody else a chance first. Yes, sir. Come up. Give us your name and tell you who you represent, if anybody, please.
Captain Chris O'Brien, Hydrologic Sport Fishing out of Little Creek, Norfolk.
Question, a good presentation, but this number you guys throwing around, the slice of the pie, 105, 120, how is that calculated? We have no mandatory reporting.
I'm
talking to everybody, but.
Well, into the mic so we can hear you.
So that slice of the pie, that 105, that 120, that's getting thrown around for the ACT, how will that number be calculated? We have no mandatory reporting for recreational anglers. And that's a.
Yeah, so this is a projection. So obviously they're not going to be able to enforce that they catch exactly this much. But like I said, that's where the ACT comes in as opposed to fishing to the ACL. So what they do when they determine those numbers is said, judging by the last 3 years of harvest, this is what we can expect Virginia to catch in wave three, which is May through June, wave four, July and August. And then they divide that up between the days within that two-month period and say this is about when Virginia would get to 120,000 pounds. And it's just, it's a way that they can balance it out so that by a certain day they're getting as close as they possibly can to that 500,000. And it's almost guaranteed that it's not going to be Virginia's at 120, North Carolina's at 300, whatever it might be. But that's why they have that 500,000 versus 620,000 built in there, so that, because like you said, there's no mandatory reporting, so they can't enforce this exactly.
Can I say something in the June?
You have to go through.
I'm sorry. Can I say something?
Yes, ma'am.
In the December FMAC meeting, we voted on a landing permit that was mandatory, and I haven't heard any of it in the VMRC meetings. There's been two VMRC meetings, so we did vote that through. And I'm just curious why that has not been talked about in the VMRC meetings, since it's pretty pertinent that we get logical data.
Yeah, well, it hasn't been brought to the commission yet, but it's, you know, it's, we are set with that, Beth, but, you know, we've had a mandatory reporting requirement in place for striped bass, and We still don't see more than 40% of those that pick up that permit actually reporting. So it's, I don't know that it's a guaranteed way out of the management. But.
If we were to entertain that, like a hunting license, if you don't report, you lose your license, then we wouldn't have that problem.
Well, we did make that threat with striped bass. It's actually in the regulation, and yet it was still at about 40%.
Was that advertised?
Yeah.
Thoroughly?
We did our best. I mean, I remember Lewis being challenged on whether or not we had advertised that very well. And it was part of the permit sign-up process, yeah. So it is something that not that that's going to – I mean, it's still in the works for COVID. And like I said, our IT people have everything in place for making this happen, similar to what we've done with striped bass. So.
Yes, Scott.
But I think to answer your question, Chris, it's all a guesstimate. There's no hard data, I don't think, on any of it.
You know, that's a systemic problem in fisheries management. You know, a couple of numbers I have off the top of my head from MRIP, July, August 2014, that wave in Virginia, we were, you know, noted as catching 70,000 pounds roughly, harvesting 70,000 pounds. The same period, 2015, July, August 2015, 870,000 pounds. I mean, come on now, that's an 830% increase. That doesn't make sense. It literally doesn't make sense. And the average fish, I think they said we harvested in Virginia, was 41 pounds. I mean, out of the 300 Kobe I caught, the average was probably 22 pounds, 22 to 25. And it's that's not accurate. I mean, a 41-pound Kobe is, you know, pushing 50 inches. And you don't go out every day and catch a 50-inch cobia. I mean, we catch them, but it's not common. Your average size fish is going to be that, you know, 37 to 45-inch fish, 44-inch fish. And that's 535 hours on the water, you know, 85 days fishing. You know, we're out there, you know, we see this thing firsthand, and that's, you know. And last point, and before I start blabbing, but, like, again, 500-plus hours on the water, I was not dock assessed once. I was never asked, you know, by anybody about my catch, what I'm seeing on the water. So who's being questioned, who's being assessed, who's providing data, and what is the validity of the data that's being presented to these MRIP, you know, data collectors? So that's just, you know, yeah, my two cents.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay. I can at least speak to the first couple points there. I got the NOAA data right in front of me, which for the people who weren't at last FMAC, NOAA supplements its weight data. The Southeast Regional Office supplements its weight data because of the fact that MRIP weight data is not always fully reliable. And so the average cobia was 34 pounds in 2015. Still bigger than what he had suggested, but it was not 41 pounds. And then the wave four data for Virginia, the July-August period, was 91,000 in 2014 and 519,000 in 2015. So still a pretty large discrepancy, talking about factor four and a half.
Yeah, Mom.
I'm Mike Avery. I'm a charter boat captain, a recreational fisherman. I also represent the Virginia Saltwater Sport Fishing Association here in Virginia. Our recommendation to you as the committee members in the FinFish committee is to vote that Virginia go out of compliance. Now, I realize this is purely symbolic because your vote is not binding. It doesn't set the regulations. I say that to go out of compliance because there are so many other things happening in the background that's not even being talked about in this room. And I've been working with Jonathan French for over a month now, and the coalition of captains and anglers working against this closure. There's a lot of congressmen getting involved, a lot of representatives getting involved. They're all putting pressure on NOAA Fisheries. I personally even submitted an IG complaint against NOAA Fisheries to the Department of Commerce IG, and I didn't think anything would come of it, but they actually called me last week, and we had a good hour-and-a-half session with an IG representative, and they, at least the IG representatives, put it high on their priority list to consider reversing the action that the NOAA has put for this closure. So I'm saying there's a possibility that NOAA may decide on their own to reverse this closure on their own and relieve Virginia from having to make these tough decisions. So I would encourage then the committee members here to consider voting to go out of compliance, just as the North Carolina FinFish committees, advisory committees have done. I'm not sure it's going to be worthwhile in this room here today to figure out how much we go out of compliance, what the limits are, what the size limits are, what boat limits there should be. I don't think we can even come to an agreement after we can spend the next 12 hours in this room talking about that. I don't think it's going to happen. But I think if you voted simply to non-comply with the federal closure, that will send the message, and it will be heard. You don't think that this committee is heard. It will be heard by NOAA, and that will put even more pressure on them, because the last thing the federal government wants is for their states to even talk about going out of compliance. So the more we talk about going out of compliance, the more pressure it puts on NOAA to reverse the closure. So I would encourage the committee members to put a motion on the table and vote to go out of compliance. Thank you.
I have a question for you, if you don't mind.
Yes, sir.
As a captain, how would this work for you as a catch and release fishery? Do your customers have to have some to take home?
We would have only a very small number of customers that would charter a captain for catch and release. Most of the customers out there, and I'll let the other captains speak for themselves, but most of the customers out there want to bring home some fish.
I agree.
And my opinion is very few of them will want to divide up one fish, even if it's a large fish. So we're talking about massive cancellations of the charter captains, of customers, if we go to one fish or even no fish. I think I would probably not have any charter customers at after the closure if we were closed completely and couldn't even catch one fish. I'd venture to guess that I wouldn't even have any customers.
I take it then that most of your charters for cobia are single species. You don't fish for anything else to speak of when you're fishing for cobia?
Well, I mean, if there are other fish to be, if you get a limit quickly and you catch two or three fish, and most customers, if you have four or five anglers on the boat, they don't have to have one cobia each. But if they had, you know, at least some fish to bring home, if they were dividing two fish or three fish among four or five people, then you, if you caught that limit early, then you can go catch some flounder or tautog or whatever's open and whatever's biting. But there are a lot of customers that's all they want is cobia.
Okay.
So it varies.
All right. Appreciate it.
So, Mike, a two or three fish boat limit would work for you? Is that what you said?
That would work for me personally, yeah. Now, can we sell that to the rest of the public? I don't know. I think so. I think three fish boat limit is acceptable. And I think we could still sell charter trips with at least three fish. Now, I'm only talking about 2016. I'm not saying we sign up to a small boat limit from here to eternity. I'm only talking about getting this by 2016. We addressed 2017 with the update to the fisheries management plan.
And what length of cobia would you think could be the least, could be the best we could do?
Personally, now I'm just speaking for me personally.
That's what we're after.
I concur with West Blow's proposal at three fish, with one of the three fish being over 50 inches. I think that's reasonable. It shows that we're conserving. We're making an effort to reduce our catch in Virginia. That means we can't bring home three large fish. So that, to me, that would mean keep our limit of 37 and one fish over 50 inches. That means we can only bring home one large fish, and that protects the spawning females that come in here. Okay, somewhat.
Trying to get a feel for what if the commission says we're not going to go out of compliance, and I don't have a feeling one way or the other, but I want to know what our options are if that happens.
Yeah, so. And the problem we start talking about boat limits. You ask five anglers, you're going to get five different opinions.
No doubt.
And that's a tough one.
Okay.
That's just my personal opinion. You know, we've tried to do some polling, and the results are just all over the map on what anglers will accept.
Yeah, unfortunately, we're in a tight spot. So, all right, I appreciate your comments, Mike. Oh, yeah. I'm sorry.
So, but your first druthers is to go out of compliance. That's what you would prefer to see.
My first druthers is simply to go out of compliance and just keep our regs the way they are, and just to go out of compliance. That should be our first course of action with NOAA, is to not accept this data they're giving us. I concur with everything Jonathan told us. Even if you accept the fact that, you know, the Gulf cobia and Atlantic cobia and somehow the Gulf cobia, you know, somehow go to Jacksonville and decide, well, I guess I got to turn around. I can't cross these state boundaries. There are tagging data from Virginia that shows that some of our fish were recaptured in the Gulf.
Right.
So why don't we get some of that back from the Gulf?
I get all that. I just want to make sure you didn't soften your stance. I just want to make sure you're still.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you. Yes, sir.
I'm going to propose formally here three fish.
Good afternoon. My name is Randy Richardson. I run Wallace's Bait and Tackle. I do fish, but not as much as these guys do. I'm here as the business owner. It's really going to affect our business down to Sam Rust, Wilcox. Matt Pruitt back there is my eel salesman. We probably sell over 6,000 eels a year, or probably not, it's sometimes more. It's not counting chum. We did over $65,000 last year estimated in cobia-related sales. With this closure, June the 20th, would probably put us almost out of business. With the regulations already on striper killing us, there's no flounder. We got to come up with something. Going out of compliance, yes, I agree with that. I kind of agree with maybe going out of compliance with a 42-inch fish instead of 37. And I would volunteer to be a mandatory station to take reports. People can report to us when they come in. As far as the gentleman with the size, I seen a lot of small fish last year in the 38, 39-inch fish. We did see some large fish. Don't see a whole lot beginning of June. See most of them towards the middle of June. It also depends on water. I had one of my salesmen, Mr. Wilcox, who sells our bait to us. He made a comment, there will be hardly, we'll probably run out of regular squid this year because El Nino is coming up, pushing the water up. So why has that been brought up? Maybe making the fish, more fish coming up from the Gulf with the waters. Because he said with the El Nino, it's probably run out of box squid in the middle of June. They're not catching any because of the water temp.
Okay.
But this closure will harm a lot of businesses. Just Sam Ross, Wilcox, a lot of big, there's going to be a lot of revenue lost in Virginia.
So, okay. Appreciate it. Size-wise, you said 42-inch?
I assume we see a lot of small 39-inch fish. I think if we go to 42, it would help a lot. Go out of compliance. I have a lot of charter boat business that comes in my store. It would really affect them a whole lot. But we need to do something besides closing June the 20th.
Appreciate it very much. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Keep our fingers crossed here. Jeff. Yes, sir. I believe you had a – I'm sorry.
Jeff.
Sir.
Can I make a motion? And maybe if it goes through, we'll save a lot of time.
Let's hear from one.
All right.
Let's hear from a couple more people first, please.
My name is Chris DeMasi, Captain Rodfather. I own a clothing line focused on the bay. I work at Boaters Warehouse. My stance: non-comply, no change.
Okay.
No change at all, because what people don't realize, you increase the fish, the bigger fish are females. It takes 2 to 3 years for a female to mature. It takes a male 1 year. 33 inches, 1 year, he's ready. They spawn in 71 to 86 degree water. So South Carolina is not worried either, because they are aquaculturing down there. That's a big deal. Also, this genetic thing, it's been proven that the Gulf cobia grow faster than Atlantic. Trying to go through everything. Another reason we shouldn't change our regs, we're the strictest ones on the East Coast before this happened. Mm-hmm. Why would we want to give up our regs when Georgia and South Carolina get to keep theirs? Mm-hmm. No matter what. They don't. It's just, again, it's not fair. It's... two more things real quick. August 2015, what was that number?
500,000? July and August.
It blew 13 to 14 days, 10 to 20 in August. There's no way that was caught. And the intercepts. I work with John. I go around to different tackle shops, groups. I talk to everybody. I talked to this one tackle shop owner, and he was telling me that the feds come see him and I give him a blank piece of paper and tell him to sign it. And that's what he does. And that when they do wait for boats, they wait for the guys that are known for cobia. Maybe not the charter guys, but there's guys right next there, clean and flounder. They don't go and ask them. They wait until they actually see a cobia. And this is sworn from him. And last thing, June 20th, no. Every tournament we have is August. All the revenue that will be lost. Everything. Non-comply.
All right. Thank you very much. One more before you, John. Will it be short?
Yeah, it's only a couple on you. Go ahead and start.
I'm Captain Will Bransom. I'm a retired Navy captain and commanding officer, and I'm a president of Norfolk Anglers Club.
Thanks for allowing me to talk to you tonight. This obviously is not the first time that that you've seen me here. It was more than 6 months ago that I came to the FMAC to bring up the cobia issue. After looking at the ACL data, talking to National Marine Fisheries and NOAA about this issue, and I'll be honest with you that after 6 months of discussions, meetings, conferences, presentations, I still haven't found any organization that calls that cobia are in jeopardy. The maximum sustainable yield all the way up until January, February, March, NOAA was 29% maximum sustainable yield. That one right there. Thanks. It's only two couple slides. And so I'm a little surprised by the drastic issues. I don't necessarily agree with what NOAA is. Most of my information that I'm going to show you comes from NOAA, from Dr. Mike Larkin, the same person you've heard mentioned a number of times. I've been talking to him for almost 7 or 8 months about the cobia issue. There are many tonight that talk about compliance, non-compliance with Magnuson-Stevens Act, and I get it. The unfair processes that are applied to divide the Atlantic cobia stock catch limits, the lack of representation for Virginia anglers, and furthermore, Maryland, Delaware, New Jersey, and New York, they all ought to be, because they're all cobia harvesters, albeit extremely small. But they ought to be on a voting membership on the South Atlantic when it comes to cobia issues, because it affects them as well as us, maybe not to the same degree, certainly. It's important to remember that Magnuson-Stevens Act, it was created to protect our fisheries, not necessarily the fish that we catch, but the fishing industry. That's the commercial captains, it's the charter captains, it's the bait and tackle, the lure manufacturers, and it's the recreational. If we protect one of those at the expense of all the others, it's failed legislation, as far as I'm concerned, and that's why you ought to consider a non-compliance. I want to share a couple observations. This is a chart that was presented to South Atlantic Marine Fisheries. Now, I have gone into MRIP quite a few times, but I choose not to take MRIP, slice and dice my own data. I'm going to show you what was presented on the 10th of March at the South Atlantic. This is a slide that Dr. Mike Larkin put up to talk about cobia per vessel. And I talked to him at length about this in the next slide that I'm going to show you. It says approximately 95% of the trips landed less than three fish. I asked him, then, if you make a boat limit of three or less, what's that going to get? And the answer is practically nothing. So the question is, vessel limits aren't the answer. My answer is the vessel limits aren't the answer. They only serve to target the charter industry, who can catch up to six, actually up to eight if they have a captain and crew. And I've proposed that in the past to exclude for hire crews from calculation. It almost can't be calculated what that'll do for you, but it's a positive step. But talking with Mike Larkin, you got 72% catch one fish, 16%, and you can do the math, 95%. Boat limits aren't going to get you anything, really. Something that came out of the South Atlantic Fisheries meeting in March was a call for a couple data items. One was a incremental one-inch size limit from 33 fork length to whatever it was. I don't know if it was 41 or 44 or something. And then another question was a boat limit from 1 to 6. My question to you is, where's that data? The only thing I've seen is a combination of boat limits and vessel limit, or boat limits and size limits. The specific requirement was one-inch increments, show us what that does for you. Another was boat limits, what will that do for it by yourself? And then another was the combination of the two. All that seems to be floating around is combination of boat limits versus this, okay? We need to look at that. Another question that Jonathan French brought up about the negativity of future ACLs with boat limits, I wholeheartedly endorse that. The next slide that he presented during the meeting was minimum size limits. Right here you see fork length. I want to draw your attention. That's a smaller fish. That's about 4 inches smaller. I want to make sure everybody knows that, because up until tonight, Ryan, when you posted yours, thank you, you did total length, which is what Virginia does, the only fishery that does that. So when you look at his slide, it's in fork length. I looked at this and said, well, if you went to a 39-inch, which is basically a 43-inch total length Kobe in Virginia, that's 35.4% of the Atlantic stock cobia based on last year's data, NOAA's data. And if you took Virginia alone and said, well, we're 47% of that, and you went to a 44-inch minimum cobia, that's 282,000 pounds of fish that you would not have caught last year. Cobia, 100% matures, and Joe, you were part of the stock assessment, 31-inch cobia, fork length, 35-inch total length, 100% of those cobia are sexually mature. Okay, so you look at the far end of that, 33 inches where the South Atlantic, all the federal fisheries are, we're at 37 total length. All those fish that are mature in that 5 or so, 6-inch slot range, that's all potential benefit to the spawning biomass in the future. It's a bigger fish. So I encourage you to at least consider a minimum size increase, modest, 50-inch. Hey, Lewis, I'm not sure if I should tag it or submit a citation if I catch a 50-inch cobia, if it's one per boat. It's just not, yeah, tag it and release it. Oh, yeah. The problem I have with the large fish, truly large fish, the ones that get up 44, 45 inches, is the release mortality. Right now, they're holding in the stock assessment about 5%. I don't know how many people, captains here, you know, when you're going to get a 45 to 50-inch cobia, you're going to break out your drum net. It's not a striper net anymore. We know what happened there. But you're going to break out your big black drum net, and you're going to net that big fish. That's a bit problematic. People are going to go for the gaff. And so how do you catch the, how do you manage that release mortality that is no doubt going to increase if you create a large fish and a very small limit, because anglers aren't going to be able to do that. And so and then the other thing is altering the opening closing dates. I think that's something you also ought to consider. You look at when our fish are in our area, when it's best for the recreational and the charter industries, and then you look at an amount. And, Chief, that's something that your staff has got to do to say, is it a 60-day, is it a 90-day window? What would be best? We need to consider that, look at that, to give our charter fleet and our recreationals. And I'm not a charter captain. I'm a commercial tow and salvage captain. So I'm not a charter captain for fishing and nor a commercial fishing hook and line guy. The one thing that I'm adamant about is preserving the one fish per person per day cobia limit that Virginia established like 7 years ago, almost, at least 7 years ago. We're the only state. Florida is the only other state that did it, and they did it last year, and a limit of 6 per boat. They're the only state that did it. And now North Carolina is going to join in and do that. And that's all great, and I applaud a one fish per person cobia limit for all states. I think it's enough. But to go less than a boat limit of 6 means you're going to cut charter captains. You're going to have to decide at the dock who's going to get the south end and who's going to get the north end of the fish. And if you got strangers, then it can get a little dicey if they got 150.7-inch cobia and somebody wants to take it down the street to get weighed for a citation, and it's just it's not a happy business to put the charter guys. So basically what I'm saying is cobia landing permit. Back in December, you approved our request to do that. That is a very good method for Chief and his staff to reach back to the cobia anglers, the people who have declared themselves cobia anglers, to reach back to them like North Carolina does to me, even though I haven't had a North Carolina fishing license in about 5 years. They still call me and say, have you fished fin fish in the last 30 days, etc. We have the opportunity to do that. We can also get near-term reporting of cobia catches by recreational anglers, something that we don't get necessarily accurate data from MRIP. It's certainly not timely, which is what the chief's going to do. Boat limits, I've already talked about it. I don't think it generates meaningful offsets, but that's data that NOAA has supposedly put together that I have not seen. Increasing the size limit, probably the most effective. That's my opinion, and that's Mike Larkin's opinion. Managing the season dates, preserving the one fish per person per day regulation, need to keep that in place. And then noncompliance. The system's it's broken. It's not right for Virginia anglers. For all the reasons have been talked about. I was in Florida when the red snapper fishery closed down from 30 days the year before to a 10-day season, literally a week or two before the season was to open. You want to talk about destructive policy. That's it right there in a nutshell. The season went from 30 days the year before, which was not enough, to 10 days. And it decimated the charter captains down there because they're canceling and refunding money. Don't want to put our charter business, our commercial fishing people in that position. Okay? Subject to your question, sir? That concludes.
Just Rob has a comment.
I think this might help one thing that when the South Atlantic Council was meeting on March 10th, they talked about the gradient, the size limit.
Yes, they did.
They talked about even for those states to have two fish lowering the possession. They talked about the size limits going up. They talked about coupling everything. Those were for framework actions for 2017. Mm-hmm. They weren't for 2016. What was going on for 2016 is Michelle Duvall was nice enough to let me have her attention while that meeting was going on so that I was able to send her emails. Not as good as being there, but at least I had an open ear. And at the same time, Michelle did speak up for Virginia several times about not neglecting Virginia. But that's really the mechanics. And I thought that might be confusing. You're the first one to bring that up. But in fact, those are frameworks for 2017. So NIPS is already looking forward to having conservative measures for Georgia through New York for 2017 based on whatever the results are from the various options that you mentioned. So I wanted to sort of clarify.
Yeah, when I spoke to Mike Larkin, he was doing the data. I talked to him when he was down in Puerto Rico at the Caribbean Fisheries Management. And he was doing that data up as a precursor to amending the 20 June 2016 closure. Those options were part of that calculation for the June 20th interim message that he sent out on the 8th of March or whenever it came out, that they were going to look at those options that were discussed in the South Atlantic as possible segues to extend the season discussion points. But it was going to apply to the whole Atlantic, not to individual states. So I need to make that clear.
Well, so let me ask you, it appears to me, and a lot of people have tuned in to what Mike Mark is up to, but more importantly, what that council's up to. So it seems to me that the South Atlantic Fishery Management Council at some point will look at 2017, and they will look at these types of measures to hold the KCT, the catch target, to 500,000. And then they'll have to decide which of the measures they want to take forward. I think that's part of the progression as well.
Well, certainly, you know, getting all the states in line to a certain course is certainly it's a wonderful idea. In practice, I don't think it's going to happen. But I remember from the March 10th meeting that, and talking with Mike Larkin afterwards, that he was looking at these to see what options are available to adjust this year's target date. And they might apply to next year. But I got to remind anglers to be careful what you ask for, you know, with these regulations. If you ask for boat limits, you're liable to live with them for a long time.
The other part I read, and I don't know whether anyone else read this, but when they were coming up, I guess 2014, when they set the ACL, one ACL, not 3 years, but we really could have only had 1 year, 2015. When they were doing that, the information I read was they wanted a season closure. They didn't want to tamper with the bag, right, or the size. They definitely wanted a season closure. And I'm thinking to myself, maybe they felt that way at the time, but it would have been good to have some measures at that point.
I think for the anglers, the charter community and the recreational, they need to look at, and the commercial are kind of excluded from all this discussion, but they need to look at what each of those options mean. You know, how much pain, you know, keeping the season open for two fish per boat might sound great for recreational anglers who fish one or two people or three people. Yeah, great, it really doesn't apply to them. But for charter captains who book four or five strangers on a boat and they catch one fish, how are you going to adjudicate that, Captain, at the dock? When a guy says, hey, I caught my citation, I want to weigh it, and you're in Little Creek, I had this example, I cooked the scale at Lyons and Brook. That's all right, I'll go to Little Creek. Went to Little Creek. Well, there's his Brook. Well, now you're going to tell five strangers that they got to take this 50-inch fish, and they're going to go to Ocean's East. And no, don't put the captains in that position. And yeah, one big 50-inch Kobe is a lot of meat, but, you know, customers pay hundreds of dollars to charter a captain. They kind of want to catch some fish. So I say keep the Virginia one per person.
I mean, I think you brought up a good example. However, at the same time, you know, what we talk about is there's only three intercepts that were used that had fish from the charter. And as you know, in 2014 and 15, no trips had more than three fish. So we all know there were trips with more than three fish.
Certainly.
It's the survey. I mean, deficiency is not so much the survey on this case. Deficiency is it's pretty hard to get those intercepts. Now, this year, we have the survey. I think everyone can appreciate that. It wasn't with open arms, but we do have the survey. And what's allowed, which was last year, but still doesn't amount, from what I know, to good censusing of the charter, is the fact that you can be at a private boat dock where you're assigned as private boats.
Or Navy boat, a Navy
boat. If you get a charter that comes in, you can sample that. So someone said earlier, you know, the feds didn't do this or that. Well, from now on, you're going to have to say DMRC.
Well, I know in some cases, charter captains, I know Austin's one of them, he's been intercepted at the dock. When they find out he's a charter captain, they exclude him from their survey. And instead, he's been phone surveyed. There's other captains who have been surveyed at the dock as charter
captains. LPF, the large pelagic survey, once they find out he's in state waters.
But that's where your landing permit is going to help you out, Chief.
So the Emirate is not
okay.
In the near term, I'm not an Emirate expert, but I've taken enough of leave.
What I'm getting to is the permit, the first item that you have out there. Okay? Now, one thing about the permit, if we don't have compliance, and the fellow from Wallace's was nice enough to say he would, you know, look at compliance, you can't really do that. Although, good gesture, and I'm sure it'll do a good job. But with compliance, if we don't get compliance, then we introduce our own bias. So we heard Joe say about 40% on the striped bass trophy permit, even though in the regulation it says you have to report even if you didn't have any activity. And in 2017, it will be definite. When you get the permit in 2017, it will say on the permit, if you fail to report, you don't get a permit the next year.
Right.
We're going to do the same thing with Toby. But still, there's a risk of non-compliance with reporting.
But you have.
Just as bad as having a rare event that NRIP has to send.
But you have an opportunity that NRIP doesn't give you, and that's the reach back to the captain or the recreational angler. Call and do phone surveys if you can. To do those surveys to find out, look, you don't have a no harvest. I mean, I did mine on July, whatever it was, no harvest striped bass season, and my wife as well. And you have the opportunity to reach back to those anglers or to email contact with them to say, look, here's a reminder, you have.
That's where we're going.
It's needed. And that's data that you will get in the near term, and I think it's a better management tool than the lag that NRIP provides. And the holes in Emirates.
So well, my last point, and just so everyone knows, it's nice to have the same people here that, you know, can sort of disseminate the word. There is a companion survey going on for Effort. There's a traditional coastal county household telephone calls, which have been shown to be really, you know, lacking because of the use of cell phones and other things like that. So that's, in effect, that's what's produced data for 2015. By 2018, National Fisheries Service says its companion mail-out survey, which is supposed to calibrate the telephone survey, will be in use. And I suppose, and Lewis would know more, but I suppose by then we'll have this telephone book, this registry, where instead of calling someone who hasn't ever fished or can't remember what they did in the last 2 months, you'll have a phone book of licensed fishermen that you can call. And so that will improve the effort data.
No, I'm not trying to sell it, but even though we have it for now and for a few years anyway, what I'm trying to tell you is things are going to change, and National Marine Fisheries Service should understand that. I think that they do understand that. EMRIC itself, if you've been around for MERS, like I have for many, many years, you should be able to see a glimmer of hope. But if you want accuracy, we're never going to have complete accuracy. You know that. That's our future. And the other thing I'd say, to extend the point, is I've never known the EMRIC data to be changed just by the will of the people. We tried it with Strike Bass. We used to meet in that room there. We had all these unbelievable striped bass back when live eel fishing was catching on, but there were lots of big striped bass. We thought we need to change that. It didn't happen. Summer calendar, we had 95,000 fish in wave two. Impossible. But yet, did we get a change? No. So there's lots of instances where I know we all have said things about Ember, but frankly, it hasn't changed. National Marine Fisheries Service still is the final arbiter of EMRIC. So the system is something that we'll introduce FMAC to. I don't think we've done that since we took over the survey, but we probably should spend some time at a later meeting doing that later. But I like your points. I appreciate it.
I think with your saltwater journal and online reporting you have for tilefish or stripers, although I've got one in trophy, it's not hard to do.
Yeah.
It's easy. And,
well,
And it's real data, or at least it's reported data, and it's more near term than you're going to get from EMRIC. And that's something that in the future you could use to compare and contrast EMRIC.
I'm not discounting it, and I just want to make sure that everyone goes home and says, you know what, I'll comply with the report and tell us the word.
Well, getting the word out to the anglers clubs, to the bait shops, a reminder. I mean, I do it with our club and our newsletter and put the word out like that. That's what happened.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. I would like to add, MRIP is being reviewed by the National Academy of Sciences. That should be sometime next year that they get back to us. And Ryan, the 92,000 trips, was that just for Virginia last year? So that's a three-month season, more or less, right?
Yeah, maybe a little bit more, but as they said, not all of them are fishable. So.
But that's an average of about 1,000 trips per day throughout the entire season. Okay. John, yeah, we'll let you.
I'll be quick so Skip can make his motion because he's chomping at the bit. Yeah.
Well, let me stop here for a minute. This is so critical, and we're so pleased to have so many people get in depth that they have on this, that we want to take the time to listen to everybody and make sure we've done everything we can, because I know how much it's going to hurt people that rely on this fishery. And we've got an image to try to repair here with this MRIP.
So there's so many things after Ryan's presentation that I'm almost worried that I'm not going to tackle all of them, but I'll touch on the high points in the interest of getting to Skip. Number one, the issue of whether or not the policies that were put in place before the data was even accrued aligned with National Standard Number 4 wasn't addressed. Again, specific language that the any policies are fair and equitable to all fishermen. And as the gentleman, I'm sorry, I can't see your name tag down there, but Wes. Oh, hi, pleased to meet you. But that you pointed out that this is not equitable or fair, and that's carried out in such a manner that a particular individual, corporation, or entity acquires an excessive share of the privilege. The way the policies were designed inherently put the states at odds each other. Well, I'm probably the one person in this room that will defend North Carolina as much as I'll defend Virginia. Maybe you can take measurements on who got screwed more, but you both got screwed. And that is, again, no point that's been made at any other meetings, including South Atlantic, contests that. Point number two was Ryan mentioned that this is purely a mechanism of data that is available and that there's no recourse. The policy decisions were made by people before the data was collected. The data itself produced an outcome. I want to reference September of 2010, Greg Waugh, this is 3 years before the stock assessment was complete. And when we get to COBIA 1, the two councils are splitting so that one of the joint actions, but for the portion we will be managing, our likely ACL is going to be considerably below current catches. So we need to look at modifying our regulations. Right now there's two fish bag limits. We need to look at modifying those regulations to ensure that an ACL is not exceeded. There's plenty of other discussion from representatives from South Carolina, representatives from Florida, and primarily Mr. Waugh, that are talking about creating a situation where the ACL is reduced way before data is available. So it's amazing, and as Ryan pointed out, there were sure a whole lot of unfortunate coincidences that just so happened to happen the 1 year where this could have possibly taken place. And the offer from NOAA to go to a one-year average and discount the 2015 overages is a Band-Aid that recognizes that this policy is inappropriate. And if they do that, maybe you all will vote to comply, and then this all goes away. I'm happy to have conversations about boat limits and length. I'm not going to claim to be an expert. I guarantee you I've caught fewer cobia than any person in this room. I'm not good at it. I stink. I have to pay these guys to help me catch one. But I do know bad policy. I do know when it's inappropriate. And I do know that making a decision to restrict your catch, not based on an established need and concern for the resource in Virginia waters, but in order to get a couple of extra crumbs off the table, runs contrary to the intent of this law. One other thing I wanted to point out, just in terms of making sure that the people who are state employees here read the federal regs, the Federal Register does have the full report. That's false to say that it doesn't. That is load. And the language in it, you mentioned that it meant the council gets more ACL. Not true. The exact language says that the rule increases the ACLs for both migratory groups. The Atlantic migratory group is Georgia to New York. As of the establishment of that fisheries management plan, that did not happen. Now, I realize that there's other language later in the thing that says it should go down. I'm not asking NOAA to throw all this out because of that one error, but what it's indicative of is a pattern to muddy the waters, to cause conflict between the states, to get us all yelling at each other, and then ultimately we get our back in the wall, and it's a game of chicken. The feds might step in, and here's a little cookie to, you know, make this more palatable, and ultimately this all goes away. And we're in a discussion right now about fundamentally changing the way that we manage fisheries, and these things are going to continue to happen until that comes across, and this may be a tripping point. So please consider that when you make your decision. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Jack had some comments he wanted to add.
Yeah, I just wanted, before we vote on a motion, to state my opinion that whether you have confidence in the MRIP data or not, I personally don't have a lot of confidence in it, there's no question that the total catch of cobia last year was way over the quota, whether it was twice the quota, three times, four times, whatever. And I don't think that we would be doing our job as fisheries management people to receive that kind of data and not come back with some fairly stringent management measures to reduce the catch. Whether we do that with a combination of lowering the boat limit, increasing the minimum length, shortening the season, whatever. We need to take some serious action, and we would not be doing our jobs if we didn't make such a recommendation to the Virginia commissioners. I think that the idea of not having one fish for every
a paying customer on a charter boat is a little bit far-fetched. In the striped bass season, we've had two fish limits for years and years, and the charter captain still did pretty well. So I personally would like to see a combination of a more limited boat limit, a significant increase in minimum length, and I would like to reinforce the Cobia landing permit. And I think that's one way to get improved data on the catch.
Thank you. There was one other person in the audience.
My name's Kent Reifschneider. I am just a novel weekend fisherman from time to time, but I am a researcher. I do quite a bit of research, actually, at the Children's Hospital. And I know that you don't make decisions on poor data. And what I've heard today is nothing but how bad the data is. And so I guess as a researcher, overreacting to data that is, it seems like undoubtedly poor data, is probably equally a bad decision to make. Some of the data does support the idea that it putting a limit on the boats may or may not influence it, but certainly this season duration has to have a huge impact. I fish out of the Chesapeake Bridge Tunnel. I don't even see cobia until end of June and beyond. So for you to put that in June, that essentially means I don't get to fish cobia, at least in my area, and I'm here with a couple other individuals. To me, I think the biggest problem, having sat here for the last couple of hours, is a lack of enforcing what you already probably have in place and or better regulatory mechanism, such as I get emails every month from North Carolina licensee. Sending surveys home, paper, doesn't work. No one responds to them. They just get thrown in the trash. You're spending a lot of money and not getting any reliable data back. We're in the modern society where electronics is the only way to get reliable data from the home. Cell phones and electronic email is the only way it works. As the gentleman mentioned, no one has a home phone anymore. And if they do, it's just for emergencies or really for their computer access, to be honest with you. So calling a home line is not going to work. If you set up some type of regulatory mechanism where as you buy your license each year, maybe put a limit that it's 6 months, and that for you to have qualify for another license, I have to have had completed at least 2 or 3 monthly surveys to say what I had caught. Something that gives you more accurate data, and there's accountability. If I don't complete these, then I don't get to keep fishing that season. And maybe it doesn't have to be a whole year. Split the season so that there's accountability, and you force everybody to give you the data and give you far more accurate data than all this speculative stuff that we're working with. And then you can come back next year with more data and react appropriately and not overreact. And that's just my two cents as a researcher.
Good points. Thank you very much. All right, back to the committee. Before we go to Skip, anybody else have any comments or questions?
I just have one comment. There's been a lot of talk about charter captains and boat limits, and I've been talking, I don't know all charter captains by any means, and you'll never please every charter captain or every fisherman, but you know, over the last 6 months, even before this came up, I started talking to some people about boat limits, and there are some that would be okay with a boat limit. Not every person, but you know, I had come up with a 3-fish boat limit and asked, you know, would you be okay? And some of the charter captains, and everybody may not know these, but these are pretty prevalent charter captains. Donnie Bowers, George Head, Aubrey Williams, Ben Shepard, and Brandon Bartlett. They could run a charter business with a boat limit. So don't think that every charter captain or every person out there cannot run a charter business with a boat limit.
Well, I kind of agree with Jack. If there is any accuracy to the data at all, the fishery may be headed for trouble. We need to keep that in mind with anything we do. But with the data that we have today, I better shut up.
I was just going to comment with that gentleman said, with a commercial license, you have to report whether you catch or not monthly. So I agree with that. I think recreationally, there's got to be something to have better data. I think we should try to move towards
that. And I was going to say that also is, you know, the reason why we're not talking and discussing about the commercials in this incident is we know they didn't go above the 8% is because they did report it, and that we do know that. That is logical data. It's hard evidence, and recreationals don't have it because they're not reporting it. So, anyways, another thing, something that Wes tapped on with those gentlemen that he mentioned, I'm not going to mention any specific names, but I know that one of them I spoke with, and he does not primarily just fish for cobia anymore. He has other ways of income. So that's something you need to address, too, when you're asking a charter captain. Is it somebody that solely makes money off of fishing, or is it somebody that makes money off of fishing and then maybe has other jobs on the side? So that's just something to consider.
Skip?
I'll go ahead and make the motion. Listening to all this, and I am one that does this for a living, no other income, but I do not have a stake in the Kobe end of it, but I've talked to several of the captains that do. So I don't think you'll get this by without having some sort of stipulations in it. So basically coming to a happy medium, I agree with Wes. I propose that we go out of compliance. But with that being said, a 3-fish boat limit and having only one fish over 50 inches. And then that way you're at least showing good faith that, you know, it's not the heck with everything. But as far as the June 20th closure, Virginia gets the short end of the stick on everything. It's not just cobia. We get the short end of the stick with sea bass. We have recently gotten the short end of the stick with tilefish. Where is it going to stop? Until somebody stands up and says we've had enough of this, they're going to keep doing it. So I motion that we go out of compliance, 3-fish boat limit. One of the three can be over 50 inches.
Would you like to add a minimum size?
I would say 37. Leave that the same.
Fork length or?
I would say fork length, yeah. But that goes against what it's always been, doesn't it?
Well, so.
Yeah.
Do you want to keep the size limit the same as years past?
Yeah.
I have a question about his motion.
Okay.
Is this just for the 2016 season?
Yes, just for the 2016. And
no closed seasons or year-round or essentially year-round?
Right.
Do we have a second?
I got a question on that. So you're proposing that for just for the whole year, throughout the whole summer season, completely ignoring the restrictions, you know, for the total weight, the ACT.
Right. If you're going to go out of compliance, that's basically what going out of compliance is.
Do we have a second?
I'll second it.
Okay. Any questions on the motion? Does everybody understand?
Can you repeat the motion?
Could you repeat that? Or you don't have that typed out, do you, young lady?
I can. After June 20th, Virginia.
I'd like to see the actual wording.
Yeah, that's.
Goes out of compliance.
You really want to say out of compliance and wave that red flag? I mean, we just want to adopt different regulations.
I think we'll call it what you want to call it. That's what it's. That's what it is.
They call it a state water season.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Starting June 20th, Virginia goes to a 3-fish boat limit, 37-inch.
Wait a minute. Let's say starting at the end of the federal season, or at the end of the federal season, because they may jack it up to June 1st.
All right.
Yep. About a motion to amend.
After we get it on there.
Right now.
Mm-hmm.
and this is in state waters, three fish boat limit, minimum size 37-inch, total length, because that's what it is, right? One fish can be over 50 inches.
Only one fish?
Only one fish.
Okay.
Right.
Do we need to put...
Is that total length or four?
Total length.
Yep, I need to put that in there.
Do we need to mention that that's daily per vessel?
Okay.
Oh, that's a good
okay.
point.
Yeah. Again, is you okay? Friendly amendment.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So basically, what you're saying is, if there's two people on the boat, you can only keep two and not three.
Well, by saying daily vessel possession limit.
Right.
It's a vessel possession limit.
Yeah,
right?
So.
You read that okay? Mm-hmm. So I'm just visually challenged.
Is it possible to propose that part of the stipulation of this is that please gather better data for next year?
They're doing all they can to get the data, to beg them for better data. They're trying to improve it. The National Academy of Sciences is reviewing it, so they're doing everything. We've been fighting this for years under MRIP and this.
So on this first step,
and for those of us that are visually challenged,
yeah.
Can we increase the size of the font?
You can have 337s. Only one of them, right. Right, and 49, under 50.
Yeah, I thought he heard him, but can you increase the font size for us?
Increase the font size for some of us.
I would vote for your motion if it was 40 inches.
That
would
work?
All right.
So let's go with this one, and then maybe
okay.
you can change it to...
John Bella would like to offer a friendly amendment.
Well, wait a minute. I got to think for a minute.
All right, John's got to think.
Basically, it says we're going out of compliance. Does it need to say we're going out of compliance?
It needs to say that you're going out of compliance.
And this is just for 2016.
I don't think we, yeah, let's put it as just for 2016. Now, I would imagine the commission's going to look at this in light of what data comes in before the commission meeting, the other options and that kind of thing. So I don't guess we need to mention, we're basing this on what we know today.
I have a question.
All right. She has a question on the motion, Beth.
I know that the public hearing is in May, and I'm curious, are we allowed to have more than one motion come out of this meeting so that the public can vote on this at the public hearing, at the VMRC meeting?
Meaning the 37-inch?
Mm-hmm. She's saying another.
I'm wondering if motion. We give, I mean, the public generally is the one that's going to have to make the decision on this. So is it not our duty to provide ideas that they can vote on at the public hearing, and the VMRC can make the decision that they make at their meeting?
I don't
is
know.
That an option?
Yeah.
Do you like more than one choice? Do you see what I'm saying?
Well,
yeah,
you have a motion before you. If the motion passed and was a recommendation to the commission at that public hearing, right? I mean, I think that would be something that's discussed at the public hearing.
Would this be the only option that is at the meeting?
That's a consensus by us.
That's up to the committee.
Okay.
Again, this is...
So we should be unified on one.
Okay. To approve three courses of action. Put three courses of action on there.
That's what I'm asking.
Yeah,
can we make
so
that?
Yeah. If this move forward to the commission,
we can make that motion to put more than one course of action to vote on.
If that's what you want to, if you want to come up with a motion to add other, yep. Motion. Everybody, yeah, John.
Then we have to do something with this one, and then we add something else, or then we consider other courses of action. Do we not?
Not necessarily. I mean, if we're going to have all, if we're going to submit three, I mean, if we vote on this one, then that's the motion.
All right.
So if we're going to have three motions, would the maker of the motion entertain having two other options?
On this one? Yeah.
We're getting into muddy waters here. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm just hearing other people saying
okay.
different things, and I just would hate. Yeah.
Well, one thing, the 37-inch, like Jack said, you know, he would be willing to go to 40 inches instead of the 37.
For that matter, why don't we just keep it
to 5? So what we're telling the commission is that we want to go out of compliance. This is a suggestion as to what, because they're not going to do exactly what we say,
right?
Most likely. This is a suggestion of how we want.
Discussion. For discussion purposes,
yes, sir.
I'd like to make a statement and hear reaction to it before I make a formal motion to amend. In keeping with what Beth is suggesting, rather than suggesting limits here, why not just keep the current regulations so that perhaps we would say FMAC recommends that Virginia reject the June 20th federal closure of the cobia fishery and maintains current regulations for the 2016 season.
And put it in their lap to decide what...
Exactly. Correct.
Exactly. Let the public decide at the public
yes.
hearing.
That's what I'm asking.
Because everybody in this room agreed.
Everybody
can go back and forth. Some people want a daily fish limit. Some
exactly.
people don't. Some
and
want
that
it
will allow people to talk about it.
We don't have to
so
wave any flags. We just
exactly.
flat out reject
just
the closure.
Go out of compliance.
Maintain,
it.
From this maintain current Virginia regulations for the 2016 season.
I'd
like to make a comment. I think, and I'm just saying this, I think you're unrealistic if you think the VMRC is going to vote to 100% go out of compliance. So you're wasting your time. What Skip started was to come up with a plan that said, hey,
a compromise,
you know, we're trying to do something. This is what we're trying to do. We would like Virginia to step up and let us fish some because we didn't cause 100% of this problem. But to think that BMRC is going to say, the heck with it, and we're just going to fish like normal, I don't think that's going to happen.
Wes, I don't think anybody's saying that. What I think we're saying is we'd like to have more than one option so that the public can step forward and make suggestions about this rather than us just say this is what we're voting on.
Well, it's kind of unusual to have a public hearing after we make a recommendation, but I think in light of this, this sets the standard for what we expect to come up with. It may vary a little bit this way or that, may change with public input, but I think this gives an idea of where we stand, where the committee stands on what we're going to do. And I think if we pass this, when we go to public hearing, there'll be more input. We'll find out more of what people like and don't like. And then when it goes to the commission, they will make their own changes. So I think it says what we want to say, basically. We have a motion and a second. Any other comment on the motion? Okay, all in favor of the motion, please raise your right hand. Opposed?
Here.
Chair's not supposed to vote unless there's a tie.
It is a tie.
Yeah. I'm going to vote in favor of the motion. I mean, we can't be treated like this. I put me as in favor of the motion, please. Anything else to come before? Rob?
My only objection was the wording.
That's okay. It'll all get eaten up, spit out, regurgitated. You had a comment, Scott?
No, I was pointing out he was the second.
I was the second.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I did have one comment.
All right.
Ryan, first meeting with him, I thought he did an excellent job. I didn't meet him at the last...
We're cloning downstairs.
I was wondering where he came from. He definitely sounds like he's like a mini Joe. He's been around a while.
May, we're not going to meet in May. Okay? So we've had a couple of meetings. We did decide to postpone the April 26th hearing. By the time we did that, it was really too late to let everyone know that we didn't have a meeting tonight. I think everyone's throughout had good comments. I do want to tell you, May the 9th will be a notice. So the notice advertises this issue. Once that notice is advertised, that's when public comments come in to me. And those will be the official comments. Many of you have sent emails already. I mean, I do have a book like this with emails. But legally, May the 9th will start the public hearing notice, and you have until the day before at 5 o'clock to send in your comments. Those comments will be sent to the commission. So they'll have that in a book. If comments come in later than our mail out occurs the Thursday before whatever that date is, the Thursday before the 24th. So comments that come in up to Monday, the 23rd, they get put on blue paper, if we haven't run out by now, and they get handed out to the commission. So everything you say from May 9th on will be provided to the commission. The commission meeting, all I can tell you, it starts at noon. If I tell you, you know, people call up and say, well, how about 1 o'clock? Can I come at 1? Can I come at 2? The danger there is the commission moves pretty quickly after noon, after 12 o'clock, 12 p.m. So I have to say 12 p.m. Please come, share your viewpoints, and, you know, that's fine. So that'll be the May meeting. This meeting, April 26th, we're going to brief the commission. There will be some public comments taken, even though it's not a public hearing. Traditionally, if it's not a public hearing, the commissioner or his proxy have the ability to call on some public comment. So I wouldn't think there'd be a huge amount of public comment that is called for, unlike May, when we'll probably have quite a bit of public comment. So gauge your time accordingly, and have a great night.
Okay. John?
If anybody wants any of the information that John has, just come over here and give your email address.
One other thing, also on May 9th, South Atlantic Marine Fisheries Council is having a public information gathering session at the Hilton Garden Inn in Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. So the evening of May 9th, so that's a red letter date. That's an opportunity to give comment and get more information there as well.
It's on a webinar, too.
Yeah, it's via webinar, but you have to register for the webinar. Any
new business to come before the committee? Motion to adjourn? Second? Thanks for your help, gentlemen and ladies. Appreciate it very much.